we're back. Welcome back to Anger, Sadness, and Envy, the Rampancy.net podcast. I'm Narcogen, the webmaster of BungieFanSite Rampancy.net.
And I'm Blackstar from Blackstar Productions.
This is part one of two parts on level six, the arc. So first, we're looking at the cutscene for this level, the introductory cutscene for this level. At bookends, this big expanse of a very long cutscene that finishes level 5 Floodgate and enters into level 6 the Ark. So you've got quite a bit to wait if you wait through all of these. And we get to see Halfjaw again here, entering into combat against cruisers piloted by brutes.
Brute ships, staggered line, shipmaster, they outnumber us 3-1.
Then it is an even fight.
All cruisers, fire at will.
Burn their mongrel hides.
Very nice cutscene. Very pretty cutscene.
It is. I always did have some kind of interesting point of contention on how they were able to separate friend from foe, considering all the equipment from the Covenant is pretty much identical.
They don't paint everything green.
No, the only thing they do, obviously, are the Covenant dropships are slightly, different shade of green than ours. It's a little bit more metallic and bright, but still, at a glance, hopefully the Marines won't shoot them down, which is, I'm assuming, why they did it. But yeah, here you just see the elites carrying on with their equipment that you've seen from Halo 1 and 2.
I think they did it so the player can tell
them too.
Ones. But there's no punishment for destroying ones that are on your side. You don't lose points.
I was curious about that. Well, not only the point system, but
I don't think you lose points
in prior games when you do go against your own guys.
I don't care if I lose points. I blow them up anyway.
you're more concerned with the explosion and destruction.
Yes.
So here, Halfjaw, he's once more onto the breach, dear friends, as he goes on with his lovely elites tacking down all the. Right. Vicious, now, evil brute.
Now, one point I want to bring up here, because this is about the closest you ever get in the Halo series to an epic space battle.
Yes.
We do get to see the Pillar of Autumn go down in the opening of the first game, and this is the closest we've got since then to seeing a space engagement.
Yep.
But all this we is see the is the small ships. We never get to see the cruisers actually engage each other.
This is Aliens. This is the dropship scene from Aliens with more explosions.
With more dropships.
And big, huge, gigantic cinematic, scenes as they plummet down.
We see those
down
ships passing each other, but they don't really do anything. Did you ever want to see an epic space battle or play an epic space battle? In Halo 2, we were supposed to get to aim massive space stations.
Oh, yeah, the big Mac cannons and things.
Yeah, to use the Mac cannons. And we never got that. Did you miss
that?
No,
kind of, if that's technically how you describe it. But yes, I always wished from the descriptions of earlier Halo 2 advertisements that that would have been an option for the player to actually, either engage in, maybe not directly, but indirectly, to see them in action. I mean, all you hear in Halo 2 is that, Cortana's taking control of the mech cannons and she's mounting a defense and whatnot, getting them in the kill box. And the other trailer, they're hearing this massive, gigantic, epic, last-ditch effort as, humanity is being supposedly destroyed. It just didn't quite play out the same way.
Wouldn't it have just degenerated into a rail shooter segment? I mean, basically, you'd have a screen, you'd be like, pull the trigger when the ship is in the reticle.
That's a ship, honest. The great distances that they're doing these things in space, it doesn't leave credence to the hint that there would be enjoyable, especially repetitive gameplay in that kind of an environment. So, as far as actually engaging in it, not so much. Using the Mac cannon once or twice would have been kind of neat.
As a one-off.
As a lead-off into the next set of what's going on. Or even forcing it to self-destruct or something would have been kind of cool, similar to what the bomb was trying to do anyway, but more purposefully.
So you don't want to see Wing Commander in the Halo universe, then?
No, not so much. I think, considering what I've read in the books, seeing it in a cinematic environment would be good. I would love to see, especially seeing the large Mac cannons being fired on the ships later on, in the game where you actually, get a chance to see them take some pot shots at some Covenant vessels. That's cool.
Yeah.
Seeing that in a space environment, that would be good. I would enjoy that.
But making a whole game out of it would be tough because they say that all the space engagements are supposed to go for the Covenant side. It's supposed to be all losing battles with very, very few exceptions.
Which I can't really fathom unless those plasma shots are better than the ones they have in the tanks, because the tank ones aren't exactly great for homing.
The keys. There was the keys loop. I mean, he managed to defeat several superior ships by use of a specific tactic.
Right. And, well, you got to think, I mean, what's the time involved? How long did making that maneuver take? How long did it take for the shots to get there? How long did all those elements go on? And you could be talking about...
There are slow-paced games. It could be a strategic game instead of a fly with a joystick shooter.
Well, exactly. And I think that type would not lend interest to
Halo.
Yeah, for typical Halo players.
Okay. Well, another thing we notice in this cutscene, we've just watched at the end of the previous level, Truth, his key ship, his Forerunner Dreadnought, followed by the brute controlled cruisers, entering this black portal that's hovering above the structure that we originally thought was the Ark on Earth.
Right.
It is now just an aperture that opens this portal that goes somewhere else. We've just now seen the shipmaster's vehicles emerge all from their own little portals above the surface of the Ark, and those portals close behind the ship. Now, if there's one entry portal, why are there multiple exit portals? And if the portal that you exit from closes behind you, how does the Dawn get out at the end of the game?
I got it. It's to prevent camping. Because if there were actual brute vehicles hanging out there, they would camp the portal, and as soon as the Covenant came through, they'd nail them.
It's a legitimate strategy.
It's right. Well, you know, all's fair in love and war, but not in love and Halo. So, yeah, I think it's definitely an anti-camping feature. No, actually, to be honest, it could be that the portal...
But people ask. They want to know when the Dawn takes off. Where is it going? How does the Dawn get back to Earth? They could have solved it just by leaving that black portal in the background, having the ships come through it and have it stay there. And then it would be really clear visually, okay, this is a two-way gate. You enter in Earth, you come out at the Ark. You enter at the Ark, you come back at Earth.
Right.
It wouldn't be any question. But instead, we see these little openings open up and then close. It almost makes you feel that there's no way back.
Right. And it could be the simple reason that, you know, either was an oversight, there was maybe some technical features to it, there could have been some, you know, cinematic or graphical choice it decided to go with. Maybe one team wasn't sure exactly what the other team was doing. Maybe it was a last-minute decision on how the final portal was going to end up looking. Who knows? It is an interesting choice, and it is, you know, for the nitpickers, you know, kind of a hey, what happened here moment. I don't think it really takes away from the scene. I mean, it looks interesting enough. It definitely, you know, progresses the story. You don't, you know, end up scratching your heads thinking that this is completely wrong. I don't think anybody the first time they even played it, you even would have noticed, to tell you the truth.
No, they don't notice it here. They forget about it.
Right.
Where they notice it is when they get to the end game and the Dawn somehow takes off from the Ark.
And where's it going?
Somehow crash lands at Earth. And the portal that it enters is only on the screen for a fraction of the second,
right,
and it's not visible in any of the other cutscenes that you look at.
You don't get the same frame of reference.
Yeah, this cutscene looks fine taken on its own. It's only when you think about it later, it's like, where did they go?
Right.
That's some people.
Enjoy it while you can, Marines. As soon as we land, we're right back to it. Priority one, secure a landing zone for the commander's frigate. Keep your eyes and ears open. We need all the intel we can get.
Wherever the hell we are.
Stand to, Marines.
Hoorah!
Go, go, go!
All right, well, now we're looking at the surface of the Ark, and so we get our first desert level. Obviously, we've had a beach level before, Silent Cartographer.
It's a big beach.
In Halo 1. And this level owes a lot of its structure to that level.
Oh, very much so. This is definitely an homage.
As well as the environment.
Oh, sure. Well, not to mention you are going for a cartographer, so technically this is, you know, the Silent Cartographer for Halo 3.
And we also get ODSTs. And these are the first ODSTs in Halo 3?
That we interact with directly. I think the other guys were just regular Marines.
And
general workers and things like that. So, yeah, so these are your first supposedly highly trained soldiers that you get to interact with.
Hey, focus. We got a job to do.
And
the galactic view. Don't forget the galactic view. They look up and
That's
they
right.
say, "Ooh."
Marines look up and say,
what do they see? A galaxy. And they go, wait a minute, is that ours? And then Johnson kind of cuts in on them. So yeah. You get a chance to see a really interesting perspective and a point of view. It's like you are suddenly outside your own galaxy looking in.
The Marine Corps must have added some astronomy courses.
Well, they're space Marines.
They know about space.
Yeah, they read Hawking's before they go on a mission.
How do they know that's not any other galaxy?
It could be a neighboring one. You know, could be L-33.
What would be the point of that?
It makes an interesting skybox.
They're just assuming.
Yeah, well, how far can you go with those portals? I mean,
as far as you want. Apparently, it didn't take any time to get here at all.
Supposedly, yeah.
Certainly no screen that pops that says 1 week later or anything like that.
No ludicrous speed display to show you how your master goes.
No time travel, I hope.
Shishka will be proud.
So, all right, so the first encounter in this
combat.
They do give you a sniper rifle right off. So there it's a little bit less like Silent Cartographer. And a little bit more like Truth and Reconciliation. Truth and
Reconciliation, yes.
Except no night vision.
Yes, what happened? I miss it.
Maybe we'll get it back in recall.
I miss it, I have to say. No, it was definitely one of the coolest features that I thought in using this particular weapon and in many aspects of the actual game, because I'm somewhat of a sniper whore. I really appreciated the last-minute addition of that extra weapon feature of the night scope. I really, really do. So for the people who worked on that and the people who pushed it in, this is my opportunity to say thanks.
No night levels. You have dark levels since then, dark interiors.
Yes.
But no night exteriors.
No, and that was kind of disappointing. I definitely, one of the request lists, because I do remember them asking, you know, what the fans would have hoped for or what people would look for in the next one. And one of the ones I did mention was weather. You know, actual live weather, which they did incorporate, which I thought was really awesome. Sort of. I mean, they did their best with what they could, but to actually see rainstorms and whatnot coming in and light changing slightly.
It's not an RPG. That was neat. This isn't like Oblivion where you could be walking through a town and all of a sudden, you know, it starts to rain and you see the same environment with different weather where you can have rain or sun or snow in some areas.
But just that they made the effort, that was great.
But the weather in the level of the storm, this light rain, is pretty nice. I liked it. But none of that here.
Nope.
Sunny skies.
Bright sunny beach, just no water.
Sunny skies at the Ark.
Yeah, the original Silent Cartographer, you did get this very island-type feel where you're, even though you're on Halo, you're completely surrounded by water, and even if you do go out...
You could only pull once.
Right, you can only go so far. Here... you get this more of a plateau type environment because you've got this huge
box
cliff.
You in from every side.
Right. So they tried to give you that same kind of claustrophobic feel or this kind of isolated feel where you're in one particular area.
But the sheer drop, like the ocean surrounding Silent Cartographer, the sheer drop makes it keeps the player in the play area without making it feel like you're being unnecessarily restricted.
Right.
A lot of the areas of, say, Assault in the Control Room, you've got these high cliffs on all sides. It really does feel sometimes like a small area.
Yeah, you do get the sense when you look out over the vista that you get this Lawrence of Arabia or this Tatooine-type look.
Right. Well, that's why I like this level.
Oh, absolutely. So there is that element. So instead of a sea of water, you've got a sea of sand.
Yeah. Okay, so back to the snipers. I always found one of the most fun things to do with this area was to give as many of the snipers away. I mean, obviously, the sniper is a fun weapon to use, but you can get a lot of firepower out of the ODSTs that come with you by giving them the sniper rifle. Because, of course, like in all the Halo games, the AI is not limited by ammo restrictions.
Correct.
So if they can stay alive, you know, they can keep using those snipers all the way through from here into the vehicle sequence, which is the third encounter from here.
Mm-hmm.
That's a lot of fun. Maybe just because... I'm not a sniper whore, so I find it that it's more efficient
to
let the eye waste a few shots. Because if I waste the shots, or you know, you could get the sniper down to one bullet and then hand it over.
Yeah, the only big problem I had, I mean, occasionally I will hand off a weapon if there's something I'm trying to do in particular, either particular vehicles, particular characters, particular targets. But generally, I do like to hold on and use myself because I like prioritizing exactly what I'm looking for and to make sure that what I want to take down gets taken down as opposed to, you know, letting them spray and pray. They do have much better aim when they are actually killing things. My major contention, though, even when you're deploying weapons, is that there is no apparent recognition that the AI has of where weapons are being pointed and how they're being deployed. So that more often than not, when I'm in the middle of shooting something, somebody's walking in front of me.
Yeah, we did just walk a Marine walk in front of you while you're sniping.
And that is so wrong on so many levels. I just really wish that at some point the level of attention to that were possible. I'm sure there may be technical AI reasons why you can't, or why it wasn't a concern, or it was too much time and trouble or whatever. But yeah, that is a one particular interest point I would love to have incorporated in games. Because it's not just this game, it's all games that I've played, whether it be, you know, Call of Duty or you know, any of the first person shooter combat games. There's always an AI character jumping in front of you when you're shooting, and if that was happening in you know, any other environment, they'd be dead. So I definitely would love if any future titles are able to incorporate that feature into them. I would definitely be very, very happy.
Our food has taken cover!
Let's talk a minute about Covenant dietary habits. We just heard a brute just yell a moment ago, "Let's eat him."
Yeah, you
I
get
suppose
the...
that'd be a lot like shelling a lobster for the brutes to try to eat the Master Chief. But it's not even the first reference to eating meat that we've had in the Halo series.
No,
after
you
all,
definitely get the feeling they're carnivores.
Yeah, the Tartarus offers...
And they don't have to be cooked first.
One of the brutes in Halo 2 wants to offer the half-dead carcass of the Arbiter to some jackals. So jackals apparently will also not only eat meat, but eat the flesh of other sentient creatures.
Yep.
And the brutes seem into that, too.
Yeah, it's kind of an interesting dichotomy, considering there's, you know, supposed advanced technical weaponry and, you know, starship capabilities.
Well, they didn't make it, though. This is supposed to be all found technology, some of, if not all of it,
and
especially by the brutes.
Yeah, and yet they're the rest of their society is pretty much you know, very, very primitive. You know,
I think Contact Arvis covers a lot of that the brute society is significantly more primitive than elite society.
Well, you look at some of the other weaponry that they do have, and comparing those ones also to other Covenant technologies also looks incredibly primitive. When you look at the chopper, when you look at the prowler, they're definitely more lower tech styled and type of implementation compared to the other Covenant military equipment.
Here we go. We see one of these Banshee Phantom patrols throughout the game. There are areas where you see distant units, air units, especially Banshees and Phantoms, patrolling back and forth that don't necessarily engage you.
No, I think there's just more ambiance and background.
Yeah, but they're not just scenery. I mean, those units are really out there, and in some cases they involve you know, in battles with other UNSC units, other Hornets up flying around in these little battles. It gives a little bit of flavor. Here's another one going back the other way.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, the upper turrets are definitely, you know, more higher detailed, and they're, you know, more Covenant weapons.
I noticed in this playback you didn't go up and grab a plasma dart.
No, I didn't grab a turret, and I didn't look for another sniper rifle. No, I tend to stick a little bit more with the human weapons lately, for whatever reason. I'm not sure why. I've definitely been, you know, loving the battle rifle in all its glory. And the sniper rifle as a whole, I tend to, you know, try to hunt down as much ammo for it as humanly possible.
We're setting up an AA battery. That thing will tear the Dawn apart.
All right, so this second encounter, it's a very similar area, this kind of round bowl with the ledge leading up to it and another ledge leading up away from it. This one has the anti-aircraft gun, an inactive anti-aircraft gun.
But it is not operational, and you do hear an offhand comment saying that if it is up, it'll tear the Dawn apart. And so, obviously, taking out these characters before they get a chance to make it operational looks like it would be a good mission.
All that's necessary to do that is to fire one shot, because
yeah.
The Phantom goes away and actually drops the top of that gun off the edge of the cliff.
If
you go, if you go after this sequence is over, look over there, you can see it. It's still there. Bottom of the hill.
So obviously they didn't get a chance to complete it, which allows the Dawn to come in later.
Okay, all right, and here comes the Phantom going to drop off the Hunters.
The Hunters.
The second Hunter encounter in the game.
My favorite.
The first one being in the storm, where the Hunters come in through the door into the factory and attack a group of factory workers, the yellow hardhat guys.
Yeah, I love how they land. You definitely get a feel that they have some bulk and some weight to them, because you actually see them, you know, compress their knees and you know, push down to the ground and stuff.
It's fun to move the camera actually up into the Phantom, and you can actually see them spawn. They actually spawn, not actually in the passenger compartment, but a little bit above it. They actually drop through the model of
the
Phantom itself, and then go through the hole and land on the ground.
Well, one thing we just noticed there was one ducking at a grenade toss, and that's another, you know, interesting point with the Hunters, is that he actually, you know, saw it coming and actually decided to crouch and hide behind his shield.
Yeah, just like the elites would roll out of the way, left or right. The Hunters crunch down and
it's a defensive move.
Flesh.
And it's a cool one. I always like that.
But let's talk about the Hunters. Now, we talked about that a little bit before when the Hunters first appeared, but it I think bears another examination. The Hunters are harder to kill now.
Yes.
Fights against Hunters last longer.
Yes.
Is it necessarily better than the original design?
Because of the lack of the...
The one-shot
kill. One-shot kill move.
Well, first of all, the pistol is gone. So
yes.
There's no
weapon
to use.
It's not gone. It's back here, but...
Well, the Halo 1 pistol is gone.
Yes, it's retired.
There's a pistol in the game, but it's not the Halo 1 pistol.
No.
So you don't have a hand cannon. There's nothing that you're going to deliver a one-shot kill to the back of something this size.
No.
I could agree with that. My problem, I think, with it is that while the Hunters were always visually impressive... The one-shot kill was a way of trying to draw you in. It would take a long time to kill a Hunter from long range, unless you had a rocket launcher. But then,
or a really good sniper shot.
In Silent Cartographer, Cortana says, "Oh, I was calling for some heavy weapons because I saw that you were up against Hunters." But that's not the fun way to attack Hunters. It's much more fun to pistol them in the back or try and snipe them.
Doing the little sidestep maneuver was always kind of fun, but it got repetitive. It got too easy.
It did
for the regular
player. But it drew you in close where the Hunters were the scariest.
Yes.
At range, especially with the modified plasma cannon that they have here.
Well, yeah, that's where they did something a little bit better, but then they made it worse.
They're not that scary anymore.
No, that plasma cannon in Rocking Your World, where you had fuel rod shells being blown at you and around you and literally making you tremble, and the camera jiggle every time it happened, was very, very frightening in the first game, especially with the force feedback for the first time. It was devastating. You felt that they had an incredible presence, and if you were in the wrong place at the wrong time, they were going to blow you out of the sky.
Right.
And unfortunately, now, with this new type of weapon, I'm not sure exactly what they call it, but literally it has this very lazy-type beam, which doesn't have the same presence, it doesn't have the same threatening quality to it. And
it doesn't have the same sound.
It doesn't.
Booming mortar shell type of impact, and
thunderous,
now it's
crushing.
Now
you
it's
know,
just a big whoosh.
It is, and I can't say I'm a fan of it. Sorry, Marty, Jay, and the guys.
Well, I don't know if Marty made that call.
I don't know who did the sound on that one, but yeah, it. I can't say I'm a giant fan. It looks more impressive. So the modeling and the design, I mean, when I first saw it, I thought that those were, you know, fuel rod shells, but then it comes up with this whooshy little beam thing. That you can sidestep far easier than
now,
the actual Hunter.
We just watched the Hunter melee one of the Marines right off the side of the cliff. And that's another thing that was changed. The melee attack of the Hunter from Halo 1 was very predictable. He only attacked to the front and always to the same side. So sidestepping him for the pistol shot in the back was very easy. It was very repetitive.
And it was being in the cutscene.
I would still say the way they solved that problem was really going about it the wrong way. Because excuse me. The ability of that character to then turn around and melee you All that did was stop you from ever wanting to approach a hunter from melee range.
Yeah.
Without the one-shot kill possibility, there's no reason to do it.
Right.
And because he can now hit you from either side, you don't ever want to get that close. You can't melee him. You can't get a one-hit kill in, from the back by sneaking up on a hunter, as far as I know.
Nope.
And anything else you can do to kill him is much better done at range. You're much better off just chucking a lot of grenades at him.
Yeah.
Maybe trying to blow him off the cliff edge.
Or find some heavier weapons.
Yeah, and there's lots of brute shots in this area, so yep. You know, it'll take a few of those. But to me, the hunters are more dangerous, but they seem less so. Whereas Halo 1 felt like they were dangerous, even though they weren't.
But yeah. You got they looked more threatening. They behaved more threatening. But when you wanted to take them down, you could. Whereas you're right in this way, they physically look better. But as far as the actual fear that you get in engaging them is no, it's just not there. So they did one thing a little better, but unfortunately on the other end, it didn't quite increase it overall as far as your gameplay with them. And they were always my favorite character throughout the whole game. I always loved, how they moved and how they behaved and the noises they made and the weapons that they had. I miss the original fuel rod gun. That was awe-inspiringly dangerous. The mini rocket launchers and the fuel rods that those special grunts had, they were always the heaviest and the most scary to me.
Okay. Now, it's a short trip up the ledge to the next encounter, and we're passing now the area which is the first terminal in the game, the first Forerunner terminal in the game. We're going to devote a separate podcast to going over the content of the terminals because
we should have several.
We feel that it deserves it, so we're gonna skip it this time.
Yeah, there's so much to cover. There really is.
We'll just stop the note at this point that. A film recording that has a terminal in it is broken. So this film that we're watching now, bypasses the terminal. If they hadn't bypassed the terminal, the playback would end there because it dumps you into the terminal interface just as if you'd been playing it.
Now, was that intentional? Was that an oversight?
I don't think so. I think that's a bug.
Oh, okay.
I think it's a bug that just
hasn't
been fixed.
It happened.
And probably won't be fixed at this point.
This is the first, indoor environment on the level that you do reach, and it is fairly short. It's basically a door leading from one section to the other with a single hallway, minus the terminal. But, the architecture on it, the first time you see it, all you can think about is, the original Halo 1 hallways.
Right.
It really is but 10 times the detail. It's just absolutely gorgeous.
More detail isn't always a good thing, though.
I was awe-inspired when I saw it. The first thing I thought of was like, wow, if they could make Halo 1 like this.
No, it is impressive, but Halo 2 also has a lot of detail, and I've always thought that it's a bit of a problem. I mean, the first few times I played the hangar levels of Cairo Station in Halo 2, there's so much detail everywhere that it's hard to pick up targets. It's hard to know where you're supposed to look.
As far as target identification, I would definitely agree because the textures that were in Halo 1 were limited. They were great for the time. Don't get me wrong. They were excellent for the Xbox One. But comparing those to what's available now with the Xbox 360 and even with Halo 2, which was also in the original Xbox, the texture depth and the detail, it does lend credence to you losing things a lot more easily, especially in large, big environments, especially with a lot of the light and the shadow changes, and how the camouflage on particular characters actually works. Yeah, it's a whole lot easier to lose things or not even be able to find them in the beginning. I would definitely agree with that. But as far as the immersive quality and how it, the story's presented and bringing you into this environment, this world, I just absolutely adore the new detail. I really do.
I liked it because in Halo 1, the level of detail corresponded to the level of interactivity, usually.
Yes.
If something was just scenery, it didn't have that much detail. If someone thing had detail, if it drew your eye, it was because it was important and
right.
interactive. It was a button or a door or a weapon or a target.
Or an overshield or
if it was just a surface. Like we're looking here at a rock surface and the metal surface of the arc, and it's all incredibly detailed, even though it is not at all interactive. And the portions that are interactive aren't necessarily any more detailed than the parts that are. Like some rocks and crates move and some don't.
Yep.
But there's no difference in the level of detail between them all. You never know what to expect when you come to interact with an object.
I think that gives it a more real-world environment quality to it. But, yeah, as you say, you're not sure exactly what you can touch, what you can move, what's important, what's not. You know, maybe it's too immersive for some people, but I happen to think it's exquisite. I really do.
Thrusters are gone! Get control it!
Okay, now we're coming up at the first vehicle encounter in the arc.
Downed Pelican.
We've come up on the downed Pelican.
And the broken Warhawk.
How many downed Pelicans is this in the Halo series so far?
There's too many to count. They're falling out of the sky like flies.
Apparently.
It's a great vehicle for, you know, leaving you extra weapons and things. You know, everybody loves, coming upon, crash scenes. Saving, downed Marines. And the like, so it's a good vehicle, and considering in war it happens all the time, it's certainly not unheard of to run across dozens, if not hundreds, of crash sites, okay. all varying and, from different things.
There's also a Warthog, but the Warthog is damaged. You can't use that. But what you can use are the Prowlers, and the Prowlers are what come after you've cleared the first encounter and you've walked down into this bowl. Two Prowlers attack. Now, I think this is my favorite vehicle. In Halo 3.
Yeah, it's definitely my favorite new vehicle.
And it's not the fastest.
Nope.
But you get a turret and you get two passengers. So you've got a little more firepower than you've got in the Warthog. It's possible exiting this area to have a Prowler where you've got a Marine manning the plasma turret, one Marine with a rocket launcher on one side, one Marine with a sniper rifle on the other side, and that's a lot of firepower. And it's also very stable. You don't end up having these problems flipping that you have in the Warthog or even more so in the Mongoose.
Yep.
There are a couple of Mongooses here, and there's...
Is that Mongeese?
Mongeese, yes, well...
Is that a technical term, Doctor?
Be that as it may. But one problem that I always run to in this area is that you don't always end up having the right number of Marines. And the Marines don't always seem to prioritize the vehicles they use. It's a real challenge to get the situation you want. Once this sequence is over, the Marines start to advance on their own. And if you run to the Prowler and get between them and the Mongeese, you can try to get them on. But sometimes if you give the rocket launcher and the sniper to the Marines, one of those guys might man the turret. And you don't want the sniper or the rocket launcher manning the turret. You want a guy with a throwaway weapon manning the turret. And plus there's a Mongoose, and sometimes you'll have a full complement of Marines, and you'll have a full Prowler, and then there's two guys left over, and they both go for their individual Mongeese, which means they have no weapons. So there's no point in these guys even taking off.
Yeah.
But they'll do it. Now, maybe they're distractions for the enemy, but I don't think that's the intent. They ought to go for the same... Here they're doing it right now. Two Mongeese are just taking off by themselves, and there's an empty seat on the Prowler. And the passenger on the Prowler has got an assault rifle. So what he's going to be doing, I don't really know.
Who knows? Weapon allocation and vehicle assignment has always been kind of flaky, even since the first one. Whether or not it's an AI issue, whether it's even technically possible or whether it would just be too complicated to even accomplish, who knows? Yeah. But that definitely would have been nice to be able to assign particular people in vehicles, because a lot of times you spend trying to either get people in and out of particular seats in Warthogs because you precisely want a particular Marine with a particular weapon in a particular spot, and they pretty much, you know, have their own ideas as far as where everything goes.
I just like to be able to stop them. I'd like to be able to say, okay, everybody hold their position until I say go, and I'll line the vehicles up in front of them. So then when I say go, okay, if everybody just gets in the thing that's in front of them, then they'll be fine.
Yeah, there's always
been... And if I could trade weapons while they're standing there, because that's a big problem. The big problem I have is that I usually don't want to go for that rocket launcher until that sequence is over. I don't want to blow up one of the Prowlers. I want to save that rocket launcher, and I want to save at least one Prowler. I'd like to be able to save two if I can. I don't know that the Marine will drive it, but I'd like to at least have that chance to try that. But the problem is, as soon as that sequence is over, I'm running for the rocket launcher to get it, and meanwhile, the Marines are running for the vehicles. I've got to swap weapons with them before they get in, because getting them out, you notice that it's almost impossible to get those Marines out of the passenger seats of the Prowler, because the game doesn't want to let you sit there. If you walk up to that Prowler, it's really easy to get in the driver's seat, and it's really easy to get in the turret.
Yeah.
But the place you need to stand to get the Marine out of the passenger seat is so small, it's almost impossible to get him out of there once he gets in.
Yeah, the particular area box where you actually are choosing one option than the other is very easy to mismanage. So you're constantly bouncing in and out, watching the QuickTime events, trying to get exactly where you want to be. And sometimes there's nobody around you, and sometimes there is, and it's terribly frustrating when you're, you know, engaged in middle of combat, and you've only got a few seconds to actually switch either people around or yourself around to get where you need or where you want to be.
Okay. Worth noting, right after that encounter, right after you take the Prowler, and there's some choppers and some ghosts, some brutes and some grunts to fight in the next area. But right after that, you come to a fork in the path. And I think a lot of players don't even notice or recognize that that is it. But there are very few places in Halo where there's non-linear play. The original Silent Cartographer was one, where depending on where you went after you were dropped off, if you just drive in the direction that the Warthogs are dropped off in, you will encounter the areas in one sequence. But you can turn around and drive the other way and experience them in the other order. For instance, you can go first to the Cartographer, find out the door is locked, go to the security override station, open up the door, then go back. But you don't have to. You can turn around and go directly to the override station and shorten your path. Here, you can do the same thing. If you just go straight ahead, you'll go to the door that leads to the Cartographer. But, of course, it's locked. There's an encounter you can have here, and there's some brute choppers and some other units, but you don't have to go that way. You can immediately turn right and head directly for the Dawn landing site and skip this. Now, if you do that, then you'll only have one battle in this door area. But if you go straight, you can have two. So you do have some, you know, minor level of player choice in terms of how you experience the level.
Yeah, it didn't have the same... level of obviousness that the other one did, simply because Silent Cartographer was an island, it was round, and you had left or right, that was it. This one, because you are, you know, skimming along through, you know, sand and rocks, some of the paths are a little bit more subtle, and myself personally, I mean, I didn't even find out about that until later. In fact, I only played it that particular way once. I'd say 99% of the time, I just keep going straight, have the fight here first at the door.
Right.
Then I hear, you know, Johnson, you know, mention, hey, follow my lead, Chief. I'm in the Pelican. We're heading this way.
Well,
so,
it is a lot like that same choice in Silent Cartographer. Where,
oh, very much so.
Where you actually will skip some fights if you don't. Or you make a fight bigger by accumulating units. Now, I don't know if that happens here. In Silent Cartographer, it does. If you skip the main door the first time and go right to the security override, when you finally get there, you fight all the enemies from the first encounter and from the second. Whereas here, I think you don't. I think basically when you come back here, it's wraiths and choppers again, but it's not double the amount of choppers that you'd get. Obviously, in this first encounter, there are no wraiths. One thing it is interesting to note here, though, is that one of the things I love about Halo 3 is the film feature.
Yes.
And one of the things you can do in the film feature is to detach the camera from the player or from the vehicle that you're in, and you can zoom around the battlefield and look at what else is going on. And when you enter this area, the Covenant aren't focusing all their attention on you. They're actually focusing their attention on the door that leads towards the silent cartography area. And there are two spawn points for sentinels that are here that are spawning sentinels, and they are attacking the Covenant units here. And the Covenant have some vehicles up here. They have a chopper up here, and they've got at least one plasma turret. Again, if you play at the higher difficulty levels, you get more
turrets. Yeah, there are more of them. But
they're engaged in that fight, and that's why they're not paying attention to you. But depending on how long you take to get rid of the choppers in the bowl beneath this area, you could miss this. You could come up and maybe you'll see some wrecked sentinels, and maybe there'll be one left being shot at. But it's worth just rolling through the sequence and watching this fight play out while you're doing something else.
Well, the film feature in and of itself is probably one of my new favorites. I've been dreaming about independent camera control since Halo 1 came out, and to finally have it here where you can actually partake in whatever particular interest you in any particular scene, and to replay it over and over and over again is just stunning. It's great for filmmakers. It's great for anybody who wants to really take in all the level and the depth that Bungie's actually brought to this game is just fantastic. I'm sure there are many artists, who are so thrilled that they can look at their individual little pieces. It's like, hey, I worked on that skin, or hey, I worked on that object, and they can look at it and enjoy it far more than they ever could. So as a fan, as personally, one of films, getting a chance to actually pick the angle I want to view something, the height I want to view something, and even motion the camera as a battle is partaking the way that I like is just an absolute joy.
I think it affects even the way you perceive the game or the world the game takes place in while you're playing from the first-person perspective.
Oh, absolutely.
Having watched it
absolutely.
From another perspective. In fact, here, what we're watching right now, we're watching there was a grunt in this plasma turret firing away at the sentinels, and then he was killed. And a brute got into that. You can see the recoil on the... Why a plasma turret has recoil, I'm not really sure. But you can see the recoil on this turret and the damage that the turret is taking. And all of this is going on within the game world, far from the player. The player can't even see what's going on at this point. But it is there. And that's something that in Bungie games goes back to myth. There's a portion of a myth level, which is the first part where you encounter the giant characters, the Trow, and there's actually a campfire scene. You see in a cutscene where one of these giants comes across an encampment of soldiers around a campfire, and as you play through the game, you will come across that, and you'll see the remains, the corpses of the soldiers, and the bloodstains and their dropped weapons. And that's something that actually looks a little bit different every time you play the level, because it's not just static scenery that was placed there. When the level starts, there's actually a pile of bloody items and explosive materials that is spawned in the air that blows up and drops. And so the spatter of blood and debris in that area is different every time you play the game, because it's partially randomized. And again here, this battle with the Sentinels will play out slightly differently every time you play the level, even though you're not watching, you're not participating in it.
No, not
but
even
when you
yet.
Come up here and see the results, it'll be a little bit different. Sometimes it'll be a grunt in this turret. Sometimes it'll be a brute. Sometimes the sentinels will blow the turret. Sometimes it'll be left for you to do that. And it'll be different on every playthrough and different on the different difficulty levels, because the composition of each group of enemies is different.
So here we finally get a chance to see, after the battle, the sentinels have actually won. And your next stage from here goes on to where Johnson says to follow him.
Yeah, which I swear, that doesn't happen every time. If there are no sentinels around when you finish that encounter, then you don't see that sequence. Johnson still says to follow him, but there aren't these sentinels that you're following over to the next encounter.
Is a Pelican or another vehicle?
Yeah, just the Pelican. Just the Pelican.
Interesting.
That concludes part one of the arc. Stay tuned next time for part two.